Do you recognize this voice of the theater?
I began my career when R.H. Macy's was a theater in 1908, I think it was.
1908. She was just a child then, only eight, this small girl who today is called the First Lady of the American stage. She gave the first indication that the stage was for her one day when she was only four. Her mother, her beloved mother, whom all called Brownie, found her in the tub, a towel wrapped around her head, a palm leaf fan slowly waving in her hand. "Who are you? What is this?" Brownie asked, and the little girl replied, "I am Cleopatra," in her bath. But the beginning really came when she was five and a student in Miss Hawke's Washington dancing class. There was the school's annual May Ball in the Belasco Theater, and stage luminary Lou Fields was there to watch the children, awkward and shy, dance and act and sing. But this little girl was different. She stayed for bow after bow, encore after encore, and Lou Fields rushed home and wrote to the manager of a theater in New York, "Get this little girl by all means." That was the real beginning for Helen Brown, the beginning of a career spanning 58 years of American theater. At a recent interview, she was asked to recall her favorite leading man.
"Somehow those that are connected with the youth of my career seem to pop into my mind as very exciting to me. William Gillette, when I was all of 19, played his daughter in Dear Brutus. He seemed like a god to me, then and does now in memory. And John Drew, whom I played as a little girl of 12, used to give me French lessons between acts. As I was packing up for the auction, I mean, you know, looking through things and cataloging things for the auctioneers, I found a lot of French books from John Drew. These people seemed very glamorous and exciting to me. They were gentlemen of great distinction in those days."
You know now, of course, of whom we're speaking. Helen Hayes, saluting her, the First Lady of the American Theater, on this, the week of her 63rd birthday. Helen Hayes, born Helen Hayes Brown on October the 10th, 1900. And this also, the week during which she sold at auction the visual memories of a lifetime. Memories of more companionable days in her riverside home called Pretty Penny, overlooking the Hudson in Nyack, New York. But all is not and was not sadness in Helen Hayes' life, not by any means. There's a story that another leading man and a good friend, Maurice Evans, tells.
"Well, of course, Helen is like nobody else. I think the public image of her is quite contrary to the woman herself. I think the public image of Helen is of a very sweet lady who does nothing but good works all the time, which indeed she does. But at the same time, she's the most wonderfully organized person I've ever met. She beat me to it on this long tour we did together last season. She never missed a performance. She never dropped a stitch. But while she is, as I say, tremendously invigorating and tremendously vigorous as a person, nevertheless, she couldn't be more vague. She told me one story of herself which I rather adored. She had had to go to the White House for some big reception. And whoever organizes these things had done things very well, and she had given each of these distinguished guests a little plaque which they had to wear on their dresses or the lapels of their coats, as the case may be, with their names on it, so there would be no confusion. Well, Miss Hayes had to leave from this meeting to go to Hollywood in a hurry. She went straight from the White House to the airport. And not until she got into Hollywood in front of a mirror in her hotel room could she understand why she'd been so politely greeted by everybody on the way. And it wasn't until she got in front of the mirror and took off her jacket she saw that she was carrying this placard saying, Miss Helen Hayes.
Miss Helen Hayes to such as us, the audience, the people on the other side of the footlights, but to her family, a wife, a mother, a grandmother, just like any other, reading a poem that every child knows to a child of her own.
When I was sick and lay abed, I had two pillows at my head, and all my toys beside me lay to keep me happy all the day. And sometimes for an hour or so, I watched my leaden soldiers go with different uniforms and drills among the bedclothes through the hills. And sometimes sent my ships in fleets all up and down among the sheets, or brought my trees and houses out and planted cities all about. I was the giant great and still that sits upon the pillow hill and sees before him dale and plain, the pleasant land of counterpane.
To one so obviously successful as Helen Hayes, failure must have been an infrequent visitor. Her performances were constantly acclaimed, her career punctuated by the theater world's highest awards, and college doctorates, too. And yet, Helen Hayes found time to advise an aspiring young actress on success and failure.
I could have gone on with that and told her that I learned more from my failures than I ever did from my successes. Curiously enough, the successes scare you very much. You're just more afraid to go back to the theater the next night than you are if you've hit bottom. If you've been walloped by the press, then you think, well, there's no place to go from here but
I'll show 'em.
And you go back in a fighting mood, yes, if you're Irish like me, and you go back there and you really learn a lot. You really climb up in that performance, I think, from that low point.
From the low point. But the low points were not only on stage. There was personal tragedy in Helen Hayes' life also. Her husband, Charles MacArthur, a highly successful author, playwright, and newspaper man, died in 1956. It was the second such tragedy in Helen Hayes' life. The first came in 1949, when polio took their daughter, Mary, then only 19, and already seemingly destined to continue her mother's amazing theatrical career. Helen Hayes was not the kind to let a broken heart go untended and unmended. She plunged into activity, into work to combat polio, to help bring the country Salk vaccine. She was able to lend her considerable energy to her husband's co-author and best friend, Ben Hecht, as he prepared his biography of Charles MacArthur called simply Charlie. At a press conference in 1957 announcing the publication of the book, she had this to say.
I think Sargent once said, a portrait is a painting of someone with something wrong with the mouth. Well, all relatives, when they see any portrayal of someone they love is apt to find some little thing wrong. So there are things in Ben's book that he hasn't covered, but I know exactly why I feel this way, because everybody that ever knew Charlie had their own Charlie. But I was just reading Ben's first paragraph in his little in the little brochure that they're sending out. He said it's about a Roman candle of a man who lived and burned and brightened the world through the 20s and the 30s and died in 1956, still aglow.
We asked Helen Hayes if it was possible to select a favorite play from her long list of successes. Victoria Regina, she said, was the public's favorite and therefore a source of great satisfaction to her, but her personal performance was for Sir James Barrie's What Every Woman Knows, with Mrs. McThing bringing a special warmth to her smile. And we ask Miss Hayes for a favorite line from her favorite play.
I'm always asked to repeat that lovely definition of charm that Barrie wrote in What Every Woman Knows. I think it's a nice thing to tell young women once in a while, to remind them that a wise Scotsman once defined charm as it's a sort of bloom on a woman. If you have it, you don't need anything else. And if you don't have it, it doesn't much matter what else you have. Some women, the few, have charm for all. And most have charm for one. And some have charm for none.
When you talk with Helen Hayes and you prevail upon her to perform just for you, you do not stop with just one recitation. After all, Victoria Regina was the public's preference. She recites, and as she does electronically, we recall the original performance of her most memorable lines.
Well, I think a very apropos thing to say now, when I'm having this astronomical birthday, that figure that's kind of stunning. I think that I should bring up that closing line, the last lines of Victoria Regina, when the old queen is sitting there, having just had her Diamond Jubilee, which meant the 60th year of her reign, and she had just been celebrating out in the streets of London with her beloved and loving people, and she describes to Bertie, that was the Prince of Wales, she describes to Bertie one incident.
Oh, Bertie, as we were coming back, Bertie, I don't think you saw this. You were a little ahead of me, you know. It happened just at Hyde Park Corner. There was a great crowd there, you know, and a lot of rough men. Of course, it never should have happened, but it didn't matter, really. They broke right through the lines of the police and the troops guarding the route, and they ran alongside the carriage, shouting and cheering me. And I heard them say, "Go it, old girl, you've done it well." Of course, it was very unsuitable, the words, but very gratifying. And oh, I hope it's true. I hope it's true.
One of the great scenes of the American theater for both the star and the public. But for actor's son, James MacArthur, this very scene has less than happy memories.
It all happened at the school I was going to in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, near New Hope. And she put on a charity evening called An Evening of Queens, in which she played five different queens. She played Queen from Shaw, Maxwell Anderson, Victoria Regina, Shakespeare, and so on. And I was a student at school, and I was picked out to be a messenger in one segment. And I also was to wheel her on the final act of Queen Victoria. Well, I came out in my messenger's garb, promptly went on my knees. It was written in, by the way, by Shakespeare, but I was very glad of it. And said something. I don't know what it was, but it came out wrong. And she looked at me as Lady Macbeth and just eloquently raised her hand, and I kind of crawled off. Well, that was the beginning. Then I came back in the next sequence as I told you, the guy who wheeled her on. And I wheeled her on in my costume and stood behind the wheelchair as she gave the final talk. And she was talking away beautifully about the Irish and 75 years of being queen or what have you. And she came, there's this pause. And I thought, well, must be time to go. So I started wheeling her away, looking straight ahead, never looking around. And all of a sudden, she snapped her fingers like, and I looked down, and she turned back to the audience and kept going. I tried to drag her out in the middle of the final speech. Well, the evening got over, and we laughed about it. But since then, we've not performed together, and I'm beginning to wonder why. Happy birthday, Ma.
And for grandson Charlie MacArthur, we thought this fragment from all of our childhoods might be appropriate, especially when recited by his very own grandmother.
I have a little shadow that goes in and out with me, and what can be the use of him is more than I can see. He is very, very like me from the heels up to the head, and I see him jump before me when I jump into my bed. One morning, very early, before the sun was up, I rose and found the shining dew on every buttercup. But my lazy little shadow, like an errant sleepy head, had stayed at home behind me and was fast asleep in bed.
And from grandson to grandmother, this.
This is Charlie. This is Charlie. Happy birthday, Grandma.
It's appropriate on occasions such as this, the birthday of a distinguished lady, to present a gift of sorts. And perhaps we have. However, we'd like to reverse the usual procedure and allow Helen Hayes to give us a remembrance of this day. During her long career, she's made many appearances before NBC cameras and microphones. And we'd like now to turn the clock backward to a night in 1957. The poem read by Helen Hayes that night. The White Magnolia Tree, written by Helen Deutsch.
The year when I was 21, John that year was 23. That was the year, that was the spring, we planted the white magnolia tree. This tree, said John, shall grow with us. And every year it will bloom anew. This is our life. This is our love. And the white magnolia grew and grew. Oh, youth's a thing of fire and ice and currents that run hot and white. And its world is as bright as the sun. I was 21. And I wore a plume in my hat.
And we went to the movies and wept over Stella Dallas. And John sang Moonlight and Roses. A little off-key, but very nicely, really. And we hurried through our crowded days with beautiful plans, boundless ambitions, and golden decisions. There is so much the young heart clamors for. This it must have, that it cannot live without, and it must be all or nothing. For aren't we the masters of creation? Oh, valiant and untamed were we when we planted the white magnolia tree. And the white magnolia grew and grew, holding our love within its core. And every year it bloomed anew. And we were 21 no more. No more untamed, no more so free, nor so young, nor so wild, and aflame were we. Dearer to us then grew other things. Easy sleep, books, a day's quiet holiday, good talk beside a fire, the beauty of old faces. We have known many things since then, the death of a child, and the bitter lesson that a heart which breaks must mend itself again, that it can and must be done, and what loyalty can mean, and how real a word like courage can become, and that solitude can be rich and gratifying and quite different from loneliness. There is so little the serious heart requires. Friends, faith, a window open to the world, pride in work well done, and the strength to live in a world at war and still maintain the heart's own private peace. Dear heaven, I give thanks to thee for the things I did not know before, for the wisdom of maturity, for bread and a roof, and for one thing more. Thanks. Because I still can see the bloom on the white magnolia tree.
Miss Helen Hayes, Monitor salutes you on your 63rd birthday.